This is the beginning of Cosmic Fire Webinar Commentaries 10B. We are on page 1220 of the great book. And we have gone through a symbolic table of the symbolism of the seven laws of group work, or the seven laws of the soul, with a special difficulty, I think, on the last two of the laws listed, and especially the last law listed, but hints being given regarding what the lower four really are. They are, you know, elements of the personality, of course, but each one of those is really related to one of the systemic ethers, and there's a relationship here between the cosmic ethers and systemic ethers, mediated or facilitated by a law, by the knowledge, occult knowledge of electricity. There's a lot of Uranus in this law because the two etheric planes, types of etheric planes, have to be united through Uranian scientific knowledge and also through a kind of interchange which Mercury facilitates. Mercury and Uranus being, in a way, a pair. Uranus, the higher octave of Mercury. Well, there are a lot of associations, and what I think I tend to do here is to provide us with certain associations. Maybe you've thought of them, but they may be fruitful. And if they are fruitful in suggesting certain patterns which are really true to archetype, then they will have served their purpose. For each of these laws, there is a definite formula or symbol. Well, they were just listed, at least the symbols were, maybe not the formula. At this stage of teaching, or through this tree, it is not possible to reveal or impart the formulas because, well, you know, formulas are effective. They produce activity, results, and we are probably not ready to understand or to handle the results of a formula. Through a formula, we can express, we can convert and express energies, we can render available energies which were not available to us through formulas. We can make available energies which were not available to us. The symbol may be described, and if a student will carefully ponder upon the nomenclature of the law, that is, its occult name and its symbol, much may be gathered anent group interrelations. After all, these are laws of group work, are they not? You know, when you look at this law of the lower four, it's almost as if you're seeing the way that the higher ashram on the etheric plane can, through scientific means, vitalize the outer groups who are still working within the systemic ethers. You're seeing ways that the group process can be facilitated. It's pretty obvious in the law of group progress. The integrity of the group and its harmony is protected by the law of repulse. The group center is empowered and its direction followed under the law of service, so the individual is not overly emphasized, but the welfare of the group is emphasized. The group is cohering in the energy of love and wisdom under the law of magnetic impulse, and there is soul fusion going on here, which always will facilitate the spiritual expression of the group. And the law of sacrifice, all lesser things are put away from one so that one can bring one's best to the group and not attempt to bring into the group that which is not suitable or helpful. One sacrifices one's attachment to those factors which are inimical to the right functioning of the group. And one can bring together here as well the group soul and the group personality as well as on an individual basis. Let's see, what have we got here? And when it comes to the law of expansive response, the knowledge within the ashram can be realized, and one in the outer group can respond ever more to the inner group, and can feel contact, let's say, the outer group can feel contact with more and more energies, just as the inner group does. So this will sensitize the expanding feeling nature. There seems to be a connection here with Buddhi, I think. Although it's been said it's related to the higher mental plane, the factor of rose makes me think that we have an astral Buddhic connection as well. So we want to learn how to respond just as the ashram responds. We will as we are incorporated into it, but as a group we can increasingly receive the capability of expanding response. And when it comes to the last law, we're not told what plane it connects with. One wonders whether it, or what factor. The law of repulse connects with the atmic principle. The law of elevation with the Buddhic principle. The law of expansive response with the monadic principle. Can this connect in some way with the monadic factor? I seem to suggest that in my earlier analysis before emphasizing the etheric union. Can this law connect with the monadic factor, which works through the ethers, especially the lower ones? Well, you know, can the monadic factor work through the logoic ether? Yes, eventually, I would say, when the volatile essence is released. That's the true monad, and it is released into a higher sphere, and can also work through the factor on the, can work through the sea of fire, the highest of the ethers. But that is a very advanced stage. See, some of these stages really, although they can be apprehended somewhat by those who are still possessed of the causal body, and have to be, especially the first five laws, all of these laws I'm seeing can be utilized by the one who is centered in the spiritual triad and even the monad. So I'm going to say that here someplace. I'll do it this way. That all of these laws can be utilized in the higher fiery spheres after the causal body is destroyed, but must be first utilized, though not completely in all cases, in the lower spheres, when the causal body still exists We are presented here with laws of group work. A group work doesn't cease once the causal body has been destroyed. Take a look at, you know, page 39 of Letters on Occult Meditation. We have those, we have like 28 groups on the third level of the Buddhic plane. That's in the triad. We have 21 groups on the first level of the Buddhic plane. We have 14 groups on the first level of the Atmic plane, and 7 groups on the monadic plane. We're not told on what level or what subplane. I think it could be good to look at that for just a moment. There it is, right in front of my nose. Okay, page 39. Yes, the Atmic plane, atomic subplane, and the location, by the way, is only given for mental, Buddhic, and Atmic planes. No subplane location is given, excuse me, for the monadic plane, but we would expect the 7 great circles to be located differently. If they are as chakras, there might even be that kind of location which is one for the atomic level, one for the subatomic level, one for the super-etheric level, and 4 for the etheric level of the monadic plane, which is the 4th subplane. We could expect maybe that kind of distribution. One of the things I've been trying to do is to figure out how thoroughly that type of distribution of a triangle above and 4 below on the same plane applies. And does it apply? It seems to apply to man. Does it apply to the solar logos? Does it apply differently or less precisely to the planetary logos? It is definitely a strong hint from chart number 8, the 3 above and the 4 below on the same plane. And I think this is a way of looking at the distribution of chakras across various vibratory dimensions. We have the highest vibratory dimension, a slower frequency, a yet slower frequency, the slowest frequency, and the chakras seem to be distributed across those different dimensions, or to have their focus in specific vibratory areas. And if that really does work for the solar logos, then we can locate his heart center, his etheric heart center, on the monadic plane. But how does it work for the planetary logos, and where do we find the etheric heart center of the planetary logos? Is it on the Atmic plane, having moved down one plane? Are the lowest chakras of the planetary logos to be found on the somehow on the higher mental plane? And would there be a particular sublevel that they would be found upon? Because those egoic groups on the higher mental plane, they do have a definite relation to the planetary logos, especially even more so than to the solar logos. So those are the kinds of structural questions that are always entering my mind. There's no immediate way to answer them. All one can do is propose a configuration and wait for a confirmation, either from an intuitive reading of the teaching, or from one's own intuition, or from the words of the master per se. So much can be gathered anent group interrelations from studying the occult nomenclature, the law of those who choose to die, the law of polar union, the law of water and the fishes, the law of all destroying angels, the law of the of elevation, and then the name is not given for the 6th law of expansive response. The nomenclature is not given, but the law of what's it called, etheric union? Yeah, the law of etheric union, the occult name. And certainly there must be in any group a progressive etheric union without obstacles to the flow of the various energies through the etheric body. This will bring about increased union in the group. The etheric body is very important for this union and for the transmission of energies, of group energies. It is these laws which the coming cycle of regeneration, I suppose Pluto will be important as the planet of regeneration, and also the second ray of redemption, Pluto, the planet of regeneration, and the second ray of redemption. The coming cycle of regeneration will enunciate, and which the great Lord will demonstrate upon his appearing. Now we're looking in a cosmic fire before the great Lord had decided to reappear in physical form, so what kind of appearing was Master DK hinting here? And maybe it was still uncertain as to what it would be. It is these laws which the coming cycle of regeneration will enunciate, and which the great Lord will demonstrate upon his reappearing, and it is these laws which will gradually be applied to the working methods of all organizations, brotherhoods, fraternities, and Masonic circles. So I can see that certainly the Masons will be studying these laws. And also all progressive spiritually inclined groups. Later, other groups will realize their importance and will study accordingly. So it's well for us to memorize these laws, their names, their occult names, their symbols, the rays which are expressed through these laws, and some further discussion of the energies of the rays. Outgoing, radiatory, outpouring, those kinds of actions. And now he does repeat the symbols. We've done our best to study them above. A rosy cross with a bird hovering above it. Now, notice, we were not told of the hovering in the way it was portrayed in the tabulation of the chart. We were not told of the hovering. So the freedom of the bird is suggested. The bird is free from the cross and is in the air. The bird is free from the cross and is in the air. So it has, through sacrifice, freed itself. Freed itself. And the idea of crucifixion is implied. After all, the fourth ray rules and rules this law. And what initiation does the fourth ray rule? Obviously, the crucifixion. So that is the way to achieve the freedom. What I'm beginning to see here is these are laws of the soul, but in a way they're laws of consciousness, and they apply to the hierarchy too. So although we have to begin working with them now, all these laws have a significant upward extension and are to be applied to hierarchical life. So every little word counts, and what we see here is the fact that the bird is hovering above the cross. The cross is overturned, we are told, and out into the great life of freedom goes the fourth degree initiate in those stanzas concerning the red, the green, the tunnel, the rose. Or is it the red and the orange and the green? Yeah, and then the tunnel and the rose and the blue. The overturned cross, the cross risen above, the redemption of the matter of the cross. Gives the bird freedom. Not only the part of consciousness trapped in the causal body, but the consciousness which is free to live in the world of the spiritual triad. So, yes, that's what I'm seeing, the wider applicability of these laws and how, yes, they can be seen as really understood and mastered and expressed by the members of the hierarchy. Look at the great sacrifice, Sanakumara himself. He is responding to the law of sacrifice. And all things are united within him. And he is constantly in a state of service. And he is, I suppose, repulsing through initiation all those who cannot enter properly into progressive group life. And he's lifting up all. He stands on the summit. I'm not sure yet how that would apply to the sixth, but to the seventh law, there's a tremendous shambolic vitalization in Shambhala's approach. Of the etheric parts of all the lower planes, and especially of the systemic ethers themselves. And maybe his own sensitivity to the wider range of energies is increasing according to the expansive response. The law of assembly is operating in Shambhala. See, what I've just done is I've tried to say, well, look, these laws are applicable to the man who is still in the causal body and still in the three worlds and only just learning how to access the triad. They are applicable to the one who is free and living in the triad, and they look, and I'm wondering if they're applicable also on the highest levels of our solar system, in a manner that is, of course, spiraled up and has to be reinterpreted in terms of the context of Shambhala. But I'm just seeing the very wide applicability of these laws. And, you know, you just get the hint from the law of sacrifice, because Sanakumara is called the Great Sacrifice. So obviously he's responding to some level of this law as it operates on a planetary basis and not just in relation to individuals and groups. So a rosy cross with a bird hovering above it. The bird has been freed through sacrifice. Okay. Then two balls of fire united by a triangle, thus picturing the triple interplay between all atomic structures. We're reminded a little bit of the word of power, two merge with one. The one is already there and the two are merging within it. We are all balls of fire, great balls of fire. We are all balls of fire. We are spherical and we are fire. All manifested being is fire. We cannot say anything of the interior life. Is there an interior life? Is there an interior exterior? We can't say anything of the life of the absolute, but when it comes to manifestation, every being is fire, and the lower elements are simply some kind of adaptation or defrequencing or lowering of the frequency of what we originally called fire. So there is always an equilibrating point. The higher point of the triangle is the point of equilibration. Equilibration. Okay, just all I need is an I, maybe. Yeah, point of equilibration, and facilitates the union of the fiery balls, the fiery beings, who essentially are one. So this is a law of interplay, and it is a kind of a law of harmonious interplay, because Libra always emphasizes eventually the factor of harmony and union. So harmonious interplay leading to true union, which the second ray always facilitates. You know how it is with the second ray. The second ray of Gemini is operating to bring together, in almost all cases except the opposition in which it itself is involved, is working to bring together the opposing signs. So without the factor of conflict, or certainly less than when the fourth ray is emphasized, the second ray brings together, not just into harmony, the second ray brings together not just into harmony, but into fusion. So there is a grand reunion going on, as DK has told us. Kind of interesting about these reunions that people have and how they feel about the reunion. So many frictions forgotten, and they let but one color blend them and their unity appear. They seem to emphasize the love aspect. I saw this fantastic thing by Ken Burns on the Civil War. I feel a special connection to that war somehow. And it showed 50 years later, or was it? Was it even later than 50 years? And maybe it was 50 years. Maybe it was 1950. Is it 15? Could it be 9? Because the war was over in 1865. It looked like maybe a silent picture. And here were all these old men, the ones remaining from the Grand Army of the Republic, you know, the South, the armies of the South in the United States, they're like the flowing hair. The Northern armies were a bit more close-cropped, and there's a symbolism in that as well. But these old, grand old men with the flowing white hair, reuniting with their former enemies from the North. Wow, it was such a beautiful harmony through conflict scene, with the fourth ray having turned into the second ray, as it sometimes does. There's a transition off the fourth ray into the second, not always, but some do make that transition. And you could really see it in that union of the Southern armies with the Grand Armies of the Republic, and they all tented out, and instead of killing each other, I don't know, it gives me chills to think about it. How all things work towards good and towards union, despite the earlier conflict. It was one of those battles, as is now shaping up in the world, between the centers below the diaphragm and the centers above the diaphragm. Nothing cut and dried, of course, but the tendency was there, you know. The preservation of personal prerogatives versus the freedom of those through whom those personal prerogatives were supported. So many mysteries connected with these signs, and this, as he says, the true symbol of Libra, something we don't normally draw, right? We just, you know, we draw the setting sun, and the setting sun fits, the sun falls in Libra, and it is the beautiful time of sunset. Well, maybe at dawn, too, all things look beautiful, but certainly at sunset, the beauty of Libra emerges. There is definitely a connection, and the idea of equilibration is given. You sense the balance, but it's not as good a picture of the scales and of the uniting process as this symbol is. This symbol also is going to relate to the two petals of the Ajna Center. Those two balls are involved there. And Libra, you know, is the triangle and is, supports the that hierarchy that's called the triads or the triple flowers, the fleur-de-lis. We have the three again. In this union of the two, the three are found. The triangular structure is there. So there are many associations and links which, when they are brought to mind, can bring forth the flashing of light, possibly. And here DK is elaborating upon the symbols that are given above, and we're grateful for him to do that. I'm also grateful that I made a stab at it myself, although, you know, you never know. They call it cryptomnesia, something like that, where you read something, you forget you've read it, and then it comes up as your own idea. Or you're exposed to something you don't even know you've been exposed. Something is registered upon you, and later it comes up as a kind of memory, and you don't know where it's come from. I've certainly read these books, and I seem to be anticipating what's coming next in the next paragraph, even though I don't see the next paragraph. The structure of the former reading is probably there. This is the Law 3, the pitcher of water, and obviously, you know, this water is, in this case, the waters of life, the abundant energies. Balanced on the head of a man. There we have Libra again, although this is a Pisces law. Standing in the form of a cross. So the man has become the cross. The man has become the cross of service. It is his natural stance, and it's not a struggle. He is the cross. He has become the cross. He is the synthesis of these energies. And in becoming the cross, he is freed from the cross. That's something for us all to remember. Man is freed from the cross, free to serve. He's no longer compulsorily nailed to the cross, either by his will or the law or some extraneous factor. The nails can be released. The empty nail marked hands. The nails are not there, but the reminder that they were there is present, and thus it is with the feet, too, both of them together. An unusually cruel form of punishment. It seems maybe, who knows when it was invented, but the Romans ruled so much by Mars and by iron and by, you know, metal, somehow brought it forward, although I understand that during the Armenian genocide, many Armenians were crucified, and Christians are being crucified today by those forces that don't appreciate them. It may be the old karma of the Crusades, we don't know, but the cross is still very much used in this negative way. Of course, it will teach something, I suppose, just the way the third petal of the egoic lotus teaches through involuntary sacrifice, the true attitude of voluntary sacrifice later. Servitude becomes service, we are told. So it's balanced on the head of a man standing in the form of the cross. He has gone through it already. It is this law which brings in the energies symbolized by the sign Aquarius. And yet, of course, it's somehow ruled by Pisces. It seems. Let me see if I go back here into esoteric psychology and wonder whether the law of service, and let's see. I believe Pisces was associated with it. Well, certainly the sixth ray energy is associated with it. But I'm recalling the redemptive energy of Pisces as well. Okay. Oh, that's the wrong one. There we go. All right. Is there anything here about Pisces? Well, when I see, obviously by association it's there. The water and the fishes, it's there from that perspective. I'm not going to be able to go through all this. But let me just see if I can find on the same page a law of service and possibly Pisces. No, nothing there. So it is by association and by the sixth ray that works through Pisces. That the idea has come, law of water and the fishes. And what is interesting here is that in the constellation of Aquarius, the river that is pouring forth from the Aquarian urn is drunk, as it were, by a great fish at the base of that downpouring river. I would say there's such a mixture of Piscean and Aquarian symbolism that it is hard in a way to separate these two signs. And in fact, constellationally, visually in the sky, they are not separated. There is an overlap, actually. So it brings in the energy symbolized by the sign Aquarius, and this law is the governing factor of the Aquarian age. It will be a great age of service, a great age of service. Of course, we have to blend it with water of life am I, poured forth for thirsty men. But again, water, and you'd think Aquarius was a water sign. So again, we have the close connection of Pisces, in a way the sign of ultimate service, through complete sacrifice and self-abnegation, related to the sign Aquarius. Aquarius service and Pisces saviorship, which is an ultimatized form of service. It might be added that the symbol for law too was the origin of the balance or scales of the sign Libra, but in the course of the ages, its true form was distorted, yes, and not all astrological signs can be traced to the or these symbols, for only a few can be traced back as far as the master's ashram. And what he's implying here or suggesting is these symbols originate in the hierarchy and are authentic, and other symbols for the signs may have a more human origin or distortion. All right. So, yes, in the esoteric psychology book, we talk about the fact that service is now natural for the person who is operating under the law of service. It's a great labor and a great burden. But you've sometimes seen those people who, through perfect balance and much practice, carry burdens on their head without having to hold them. This is a more mundane example of the attitude of service of the highly advanced server who has become accustomed to carrying the burden such that it is, through his balanced carrying, no longer really a burden and a struggle. Many of us, we will have to go through the burden and the struggle of Aquarius before service is such a natural expression that the struggles within our energy system to serve are over. Then Law 4, here we have the angel with the flaming sword turning in all directions. And that is not something we knew about just looking at the symbol. So warding off the inappropriate from all directions. This symbolism is held true in the Bible where the angel guards the treasure and drives man forth in search of another way of entrance. Let's see, Adam and Eve were naturally in the garden, but had to find another way in after eating of the fruit of the of the tree of knowledge, thus forcing him through the cycle of rebirth until he finds the portal of initiation. That is the other way in, and it's a conscious way in. The portal of initiation is the conscious way into the garden of unity, and the unconscious, unindividualized human being that could be, in a way, Adam and Eve at first, were in the garden participating in a mystical union without self-consciousness. All was one. And there is no discrimination of the separative perceiving individual. You eat of the tree of knowledge, you get individualized. See, in a way, the serpent power, eating of the tree of the fruit, of the tree of knowledge, is like individualization. And the serpent, fire, or fiery serpent, which is the solar angel, is involved. And then it's impossible to regain. One cannot regain the sense of unity until initiation. Separation is given by eating that fruit. And automatically, when you realize yourself as separate, you're out of the garden. It's as simple as that. You are now alone in the world, and the garden is the garden of unity. Whether it's conscious or unconscious unity. So the garden is, in a way, the garden of unity, whether conscious or unconscious. This portal is occultly regarded as freed from the intervention of the sword, as man has developed the ability to soar and mount on the eagle, as an eagle on wings. Now, this is the symbol for initiation and suggests even Egyptian initiations where the man gains wings. I'll have to restudy that. There's the Ba and the Ka. And I think one of them is the man with wings and the other is the solar angel. One of them is Horus with wings, and he is the solar angel. So as the solar angel wings his way back to the heart of the sun, the man has become an angel in a lesser sense and is given his wings. In some of the armed forces, I suppose in the Air Force, I don't know exactly when it happens, but you receive your wings. It's a very concrete example of something that happens occultly in the initiation process. So perhaps we have to fly into the Garden of Eden or into paradise, or if we have wings, the sword will not stop us. Have self-earned wings, the sword of, well, what can we call it? In one way, it's the sword of discrimination will not stop us from entering. Right now, my wife, Tuya, points this out so much, we're like elementals. We're not yet like angels. When we get our wings, we're more like angels or devas. Right now, we're very earthbound, like elementals. We're trapped in the elements. We are elemental lives when compared to the solar logos. Eventually, we have to earn our wings and become more deva-like. This is an analogy. So, the portal is occultly regarded as freed from the intervention of the sword, as man has developed the ability to soar. Backward and forward shifts my little self, e'en as a bird soars into heaven and settles back again upon the tree. But God in his high place outlasts the little bird. Thus do I know that God will victor be, and later hold my mind and me in thrall. This is the fourth, is it the fourth? Or fifth stanza in a great initiatory series of stanzas from Atlantis concerning the third initiation. So we've had this bird symbolism of the golden bird hovering above the cross. That bird is free. That bird is liberated. When the bird is resting on the cross, it's like resting on the tree. Sometimes the cross and the tree are equivalent in the Christian terminology. He was crucified upon the tree, we are told, but the tree and the cross are the same. The cross came from the tree. The bird has to be freed from the tree, and in the Egyptian mysteries, it was freed at the fourth initiation. And you wonder whether it flies forth to, in a way, settle upon the throne, which is mastership. I like this very much, and I don't recall really registering it before. When is the portal free of the intervention of the sword? As man has developed the ability to leave his bodies via the Antikorana, the great way of escape, and to soar into the triad as the eagle on wings. Now, the eagle is interesting because it is a bird particularly connected not only with Scorpio, but with the last decanate of Capricorn. Aquila, the eagle, rules the last decanate of Capricorn, where you have a fusion of Mercury, Vulcan, and the Sun, giving a great blinding light. So the soaring of the eagle is equivalent to the blinding light of initiation experienced in the final decanate of Capricorn. It is really the initiatory decanate. It doesn't mean that it can't happen elsewhere. The symbol, Law 5 here, is the law of group progress and the law of elevation. The symbol for this is the mountain with the goat standing on the summit, and again the astrological sign, that of Capricorn, can be noted, of course. All hard places can be surmounted. This is something, you know, in a way, Capricorn knows about this, but often Sagittarius does not. But Sagittarius is in training. And you think about all of the effort that the Sagittarian makes through exercise and sport and exploration and so forth to strengthen the body and make of it responsive, a specimen responsive to the will. A Martian vehicle, a strong Martian vehicle, that's the hierarchical ruler of Sagittarius. That's in preparation for the tough life in Capricorn, having really to deal with density. So the Capricorn, the Capricorn has to deal with the resistance of density and must triumph over density in order in order to become the initiate. And the summit is reached by the divine goat, symbol of the group, viewed as a unit. Well, that's a good one. Divine goat as symbol of the group. As symbol of the group. And I suppose giving way to the unicorn. The triumphant fighting beast, white, that is purified, and one pointed. The divine. So it is not just the individual who reaches the top. This is a law, in a way, a law concerning group initiation, isn't it? The group reaches the summit together. And what seemed to be the greedy, ambitious goat reaching the top of his particular mountain of desire turns out to be the divine individual, the group reaching the summit of realization and acquiring new powers. Saturn rules the hard places of life, and Venus gives way to Saturn, the illumination of Venus. So Saturn rules the hard places of life, and Venus follows, bringing light supernal and love. Love eternal and peaceful silent will. Well, we'll have to get that peaceful silent will maybe from a different planet than Venus. The goat standing on the summit, and the group goat reaches its summit because of the efforts of the individual goats. All the individual goats are combined into the divine goat. And we are involved very much in that, and when we study the 14 rules for disciples and initiates in Rays and the Initiations, we have to remember very much this law of group progress, the law of elevation, because these are laws relating to progressive stages of group initiation, really. Let the group know this, let the group reveal that, let the group see. It's always the group as one being, one actor, one perceptive mechanism. Law 6, the symbol contains a flaming rosy sun. I didn't emphasize that, but I suppose it relates to the power of it. With a sign in the center, and that is not, that was not given. That was not discussed, and it's not really going to be discussed in terms of detail. A sign symbolizing the union of fire and water. Well, what are fire and water are mind and emotion, but is this more than mind and emotion? Is fire the fiery worlds, and is water the realm of the physical body of the solar logos or planetary logos? Below this sign is found a hieroglyphic which may not be given, as it gives the clue to the earth sign and the keynote of the physical body of the planetary logos. Well, what is meant by the earth sign? What is meant? Is it the astrological sign which is most closely related to the earth? It doesn't say the earth's sign is not in the possessive. The earth signs are Capricorn, Taurus, and Virgo. Somehow I'm thinking about the sign Taurus here. Why am I, or the constellation Taurus? Because DK said there was a peculiarly close relation through Venus to the constellation Taurus, that Earth had this unusually close relation to Taurus through Venus. But this is an ambiguous phrase, gives the clue to the Earth sign. This is not necessarily a law relating to Earth. It is relating to the most concrete aspect of the spiritual triad, namely the higher mind, and the key note of the physical body of the planetary logos. It may be a third ray physical body, and can it be somehow connected with Taurus? Sometimes I've heard that the keynote of Earth is a C sharp. All right. Keynote of Earth in what respect? Of physical Earth, just the way the sun rings with bell-like tone on the note G. There is some speculation about this and some measurement concerning this, but if you start, and I'm not saying this is the best way, but if you take the 12 signs of the zodiac and you superimpose them upon the chromatic scale of the octave, then C-sharp is Taurus. You begin with Aries at C, and then C-sharp, or D-flat, depending on how you look at it, will be Taurus. So I'm going to mention that just to put the idea up there. C-sharp can be correlated to Taurus when the zodiacal signs are superimposed upon the chromatic scale of 12 notes. So you kind of wonder here, the rosy sun does suggest the link with the astral body for sure, but a much higher correspondence, I suspect. Fire and water meeting can be within the realm of the microcosm, but also a higher type of fire and a higher type of water. Fire, in a way, concerns the entire etheric body of the planetary or solar logos. It's a fiery world. I mean, the air signs rule the ethers, but it's a fiery world. So it's fire and air, and kind of an epitome of all of this is the logoic plane, where on the chart we are shown fire and air. Right? Right here. So the ethers are, in a way, fire and air. All the ethers are ruled by air because of the flow and intercommunication, but they are of such an intensity of energy that they're called the fiery worlds. So water is matter. Water and matter is earth. Water, matter, earth. And water, you see, it's, in a way, it's the union of the higher life and the lower life. It's the union of the upper four with the lower three. We could be talking about that with the union of fire and water. It's a higher correspondence to the normal glamour-producing, steam-producing union of lower mind and desire of the astral plane. I wonder if the Tibetan knows hieroglyphics of the Egyptian kind. It is the hiero, was the priest, and it's like priestly writing is what it really means. The hierophant, the high priest, really, who conveys the higher energy. So we cannot yet know exactly what is the meaning of this earth sign, but we can wonder whether the hieroglyphic is not that of an earth sign. And I've pointed out the C-sharp. So is the hieroglyphic. The symbol or the is the hieroglyphic representing an earth sign, like Taurus, for instance. The keynote of the planetary logos of the physical body, and of course we know how much Taurus is connected with physical bodies. Think of it. I mean, in Taurus, the moon, which is the physical body of the five non-sacred planets, is exalted. So, and the earth, so often connected with the physical nature, has a special place. Earth also has a special place. So Taurus is a very tamasic, in one way, sign, and the physical body is the most tamasic vehicle. Okay, those are some, what I call them, you know, like filaments of thought, tendrils of thought, which can go out there and maybe constellate a truth resonant to the intuition. I know I'm really going to go over the time here again, but Law 7, I think it really must be mentioned in the same program. This symbol takes the form of a male and female figure standing back to back, the male figure holding above his head what looks like a shield or tray of silver, a great reflector. And see, in this we were not told earlier, whilst the female figure holds aloft an urn of oil, the anointing oil. Below this sign is another hieroglyphic which contains the secret of the astral plane, which has to be dominated by the mental. Well, the tray of silver, see, the moon is metallically silver, and Mercury is a quick silver, and we are talking about the receptivity of consciousness. Mercury having to do with the higher ethers. The symbolism of oil, it is a dissolver. It is that which can unite separate things. It gives a flow. It gives ease. It gives lubrication. Oil overcomes friction in a way. And it is a blending medium. And it is appropriate that it be connected with a female figure, which is more associated with harmony. So we seem to have here the ability to blend the energies of the lower worlds, fusing them through the reception of the great energies that come in via the reflector. The mind is also a great reflector as well. So there's a, I don't know, let's say a Mercurian sort of Mercurian aspect to the male symbol, and a Venusian to the female, harmony, oil, and so forth. The oil, in a way, giving the possibility of the blending, yeah, the blending of the higher energies into the lower energies. If oil can amalgamate and fuse and make as one, then the oil can receive the higher energies and integrate them into the lower fragmented worlds. So, again, this is etheric substitution with the higher energies being merged in oil into one in the lower worlds. If you are anointed with oil, I was just reading about this priest who showed up at the scene of a terrible accident. I guess it was a real man, but there was something mystical about it because he did kind of show up just when the prayers began. It was amazing. It's a way of incorporating the higher energies and mixing and blending the higher energies into the lower. So oil is a way of mixing and blending the higher energies into the lower. And that's what we have to have. This is a law of fusion, or a law of scientific fusion, a law of by means of which etheric substitution under scientific occult methods can be accomplished. Well, those are the associations I get from that. And of course, in a way, the astral plane is a liquid plane. And one in which fusion can occur. Mysticism is fusion, and the spiritual approach of the mystically oriented is often emotional and relates to the sentient touching quality. So we're talking about integration, fusion, blending, merging and blending of higher reflected energies of the cosmic ethers into the lower worlds. I know that if the Tibetan were to explain this, he would come up with things that are much more precise, but these are what occurs to me as I look at this. You know, the blending power of the astral plane, and think about this, domination by the mental. This is Mercury and the Moon. And the mind is silver in this respect. Sometimes it is golden, but in this particular case, the mind as a reflector is silver. The Moon can be associated with the brain, Mercury with the mind, Moon and Saturn being together in that respect. And all of these higher receptions can be blended together, and the mind, let's just say, as the silver shield is to the oil. No, as the silver shield is to the oil, so the mind is to the liquidity of the astral body. So this seems to be a law concerning infusion of the higher into the lower. A law concerning infusion of the higher into the lower. I'm being a little less careful about time, I realize, and in these I'm somehow, well, just finally, these seven laws can be worked out along the line of correspondences. I'm attempting to do that a little bit here. It will be found that the energy of any particular center and that of one law can be brought into line with each other, and maybe when we take this up again, we can make a stab at seeing how this might be done. There are obviously, if there are seven laws, seven laws, they will correlate with the seven centers. So this is the end of Cosmic Fire Webinar Commentaries, number 10B, and in terms of pages, we're only at page 1222. We're not really making page progress. And we will beginning of Cosmic Fire Webinar Commentaries 11A, page 1222. And we will look for, before we begin that, well, as we begin that, we will look for some kind of chakra correspondence of these laws, at least to propose something so that some thought can be directed towards it. I always think I'm preparing something for the new schools. I'm just doing now what students in the new schools will do. They will take the Tibetans material, they will think about it, and they will try to throw light upon it, or bring added light to it, or allow it to evoke light within their consciousness. I'm just doing that. And maybe, hopefully setting some kind of model for what can transpire when the new schools are real. I've always in my life tried to create schools, whether, you know, the University of the Seven Rays, Seven Ray Institute, University of the Seven Rays, then the Moria Federation, always schools, and meanwhile been involved in the in helping to set the stream of impetus going towards schools such as the one that Lawson Bracewell is heading up right now, the Christ College of Transmalayan Wisdom. And we've had the Moria College, some initial efforts there, and the KH College in Australia, but and also the DK College in Denmark. But in the same way that the Tibetan discovered that as he tried to externalize 9 seed groups, it may have been a premature effort and he needed to consolidate them into one newly organized, one new seed group of 24, I have discovered that the attempt to start various colleges may have been premature, and that a more concerted effort in the Moria Federation, called a federation because he's the head of all these esoteric schools, may have been the better way to go, because it consolidates the energies. There were not enough energies. There were not enough people carrying to fruition the possibility. We needed to concentrate our energies in a larger group rather than to split the forces. That's really what the Moria Federation is representing, the concentration of those energies, which one day will branch out again in a reinforced manner and help to create the new schools. That is, of course, if the Moria Federation endures. If it doesn't endure, something else will come along which will help with the founding of those schools. All right. Well, I'm certainly over the edge, certainly gone farther than I should. But that is where we will begin when we start again. So see you then. Okay.